Welcome to the last day of the Stanza Festival. In this podcast, we've got interviews with Hardeep Singh Kolbi and Stanza 2009 lecturer, Jay Perini. We've got an excerpt from today's Poetry Breakfast, asking whether poets or actors are better readers of verse. We've got Poetry Cabaret from 2006 World Slam champion Elvis McGonagall. And we've a fascinating talk on Burns by the enchanting Drew Clegg. But we start things off with an interview with Hardeep Singh Kohli and Alistair Moffat.
Hardy, what brings you up to the beautiful, wonderful, gorgeous, grey city of the east of St Andrews?
Oh, I got cabbed to the airport, then I flew, and then I got a lift from the airport. That's what brought me up. I'm here for the Stanza Poetry Festival. That's why I'm really here.
And what attracted you to come here? Why did you want to come?
Okay, there's two answers. There's the heartfelt, sincere answer that poetry's been very apparent in my life ever since I was a wain. Which is a West Coast word for Wayne. That's one answer. The other answer is I think somebody dropped out at the last minute and they asked me to come along. Either of those answers would do, I think.
I think they would do fine.
That's perfectly fine. Let's be honest.
Well, why not? Why not? Poetry is about honesty, I feel.
And yet it's also to some degree about camouflaging honesty.
Yes, indeed. So, well, let's get behind the camouflage for a moment. But tell me why poetry matters to you.
I think when you write, particularly when you write as often as I write and as much as I write, you can become quite fond of the sound of your own word processor. And what poetry teaches you is the economy of language, and it makes you double check whether you really need to say something as verbosely as you do. And it also, I think we forget in this day and age to some extent. I'm not down on technology at all. I think there's great opportunities for creative writing through kind of social networking applications. Twitter, for example, you've got 140 characters to convey a message. That's the discipline of poetry, actually. But I think we sometimes forget what language sounds like. And that's the beauty of some poetry, not all. But for me, the best poetry, I mean, I've just bumped into Elvis McGonagall. There is no better example of a man that makes poetry to be spoken and to be heard. And I think also what poetry does kind of on a British level, United Kingdom level, is it separates our vernaculars, our dialects out. See, West Coast poetry is different from East Coast poetry. It's different from Lallan's poetry. Then it's different from the English poetry, because certainly it's written in that way. I've not really thought about it very much, Alistair.
Can you remember when you were a Wayne? If that's the right word, what was it about poetry, or which particular poetry stuck with you?
It's funny, I've never had to ask myself that question before, and it's quite people's experiences of school-taught poetry, because invariably, for the overwhelming percentage of the population, the only poetry you will ever be exposed to is the stuff that's taught at school, which is filtered through all sorts of kind of taste and decency filters. But there was one I was taught at school called the Puddock, which is a Scots word for frog. It's about a frog, and it's a beautifully funny poem that kind of encapsulates everything I think that's best about poetry. It sounds great spoken. You can't read the Puddock. You've got to say it. It's funny. It's full of deep... It's got a big story about hubris and pride. It teaches you that notion of a Kentish feather very well. And it's funny. It makes me laugh. So that kind of is one of my earliest memories, having to learn that on the football bus to Somerston while I was playing for St Matthews. I think we won 16-0 that day, and I learned the poem, and I still remember it pretty much off by heart, which is amazing.
Go on, and give us the first couple of lines.
A puddock sat by the Lochan's brim, and he thought there was near a puddock like him. He sat on his hurdies and he waggled his legs. He clicked his heed as he glowed through the segs or something. Don't quote me on that. Well, quote me on that, but don't quote me on that, if you know what I mean. So from that point of view, I kind of I really like it. You know, because that needs to, that saying, please speak me out. Don't kind of leave me just written.
Thanks, Hardeep and Alistair. And now the chance to hear from a talk given by the inimitable Drew Clegg on Burns.
Robert Burns, in the language in which he wrote to a great extent and spoke, is already practically obsolete. So like multi-voiced and multifaceted Homer, Burns's tent is wheel-pegged Dune in Parnassus, and he need fear nae evil. Of course, his immortality is predicated on the fact that he is a wonderful poet. A wonderful poet of enduring and international popularity. And as we know, reams and reams have been written over the millennia on the subject of poetry. You know, what is it? What are its constituent parts? How can we define it? And we have Aristotle's Poetics, for example. We've got Quintus Horatius Flaccus's Ars Poetica, for example. So Philip Sidney's Defence of Poetry, Percy Bysshe Shelley ditto. We've got the preface to Coleridge and Wordsworth's Lyrical Ballads, which were themselves inspired by the works of Robert Burns. Many, many, many reams written on the subject. But to my mind, certainly the most concise and the clearest definition of poetry comes from the little Queen Anne man, Alexander Pope, when he defined, with a typical aplomb, poetry as being what oft was thought, but ne'er so well expressed. And that sums up one of the qualities of Robert Burns to a tittle. He is the master of the succinct and utterly memorable phrase, oh, with some power the gift he gives, to see ourselves as others see us. Man's inhumanity to man makes countless thousands mourn. There's a phrase there that we would like to see vanish from the ether in 250 years' time, but perhaps it won't, and perhaps a phrase, that masterwork of clarity, will still be as eloquent in 250 years' time as it is today. And that lovely marrying that he was able to achieve between pure, crystalline, Augustan English and the lovely mellifluous Scots idiom, when he says and writes things like, oh, gently scan your brother man and still gentler sister woman, though they may gang a ken and rang, to step aside as human. The last wee line there is, could be straight from the pen of Alexander Pope, but the line before it, though they may gang a ken and rang, has got all the hallmarks, one of Scott's idiom, and two of Robert Burns. His clarity is just astounding in these memorable phrases. I do not know of four wee words that have come from the pen of Robert Burns which are more expressive in any language, in any writing that I have encountered in all my days. Four wee amazingly expressive words, and one of them is a the. Let me give you an example. Suppose now I was to begin to tell you a story, let's say about a family baker in a wee Scots town, for example, and they produce the best pies, the best scones, the best bread and rolls that are available in their locality. And it's a generational thing, because the baker's mother and father were bakers, and his grandmother and grandfather were bakers. In other words, it's a wee lifestyle business, and it does very well. And then somebody comes along, this is a story I'm telling you, and says, here's a good idea, I own a big hotel chain. Why don't you guys sign a contract with me, and you can supply your pies and buns and bread rolls and whatnot to every hotel in the land? And so the bakers invest in capital equipment, they take on more premises, they engage oodles of more staff, and then I stop the story and I say to you, but you see, the best laid schemes. And I need to go no further, because the details of the denouement might be clouded and obscure, but we know the end of that story, because those four wee words, and as I said, one of them is a the, has expressed the whole tragedy to us. Wonderful example of clarity and brevity of language. And yet, what are those four wee words predicated on as to their meaning and as to their power? And this is where Robert Burns really comes into the shining lightdom of poetry. You'll know these other three words. But before I pronounce them, I did a little experiment one day with my nephews and nieces. I gathered them round me and I said to them, what does gang mean? Oh, that's boys and lassies hanging about the lamppost smoking the wacky backy, isn't it? Mm-hmm. What does aft mean? And one of the girls said, oh, well, Papa was a seafarer, that means, that's a kind of shipping term, isn't it? Fore and aft. Aglay. Pass. Nobody knew. And then I put those three wee words in the context of the stanza from his poem To a Moose, and they all got the meaning exactly. And that is a masterstroke of poetry, for the meaning transcends the etymology. You do not need to know the meaning of the individual words for their full effect to wash over you like a tidal wave. I do not know of any other poet who's capable of bringing about that piece of magic with language. You know the verse, but if I put it in context, I think I can compare it with what might have been. But Moosey, thou art no thy lane. Oh, what a wonderful use again of Scott's idiom, the diminutive, so that we get all the sympathy that the poet feels for the poor wee beast. But Moosey, thou art no thy lane. In proving foresight may be vain. Perfect Augustan English. The best laid schemes of mice and men. Perfect Augustan English. Gang after glay. And leave us not by grief and pain for promised joy. The whole meaning is carried by them three wee powerful, dramatic and demotic Scots words. Put the whole thing in standard English and you'll see what I mean. But mouse, you're not on your own. It doesn't even rhyme. But mouse, you're not on your own. In proving foresight may be vain. The best laid schemes of mice and men often go wrong. Oh, do they? Well, that's very memorable, isn't it? An absolute master of language. And oddly enough, in the same poem, there's the most extraordinary effect created in an earlier verse by a little compound word. It's where Burns writes, I do na whiles bother me thief, where then peer beastie thou man live. And a demoniker in a thrive is a smart request. Demoniker. Well, we know what it means, don't we? It means the square root of not very much at all. But what's its etymology? What does it actually mean, a demoniker? That word would not be recognised in Kilwinning in the 18th century, nor Ardrossan, nor Kilmarnock, nor Ayr. The folk of Aldridge, Edinburgh, wouldn't have had a clue as to what it means. It was a word that was used within only a few miles of Mauchline and Terbolton. And it means half an ear of barley. Minority language. You can't get much more minor than that. Quite an extraordinary achievement. And that's just looking at one poem of Robert Burns's canon.
Drew Clegg's talk on Burns was absolutely remarkable for the fact that he used no notes and was spellbinding for an entire hour, and it's a real shame that we can't include the entire talk in this podcast. Next up, we've got a short interview with Jay Perini, who spoke so mesmerisingly at our stanza lecture.
Okay, so I'm with Jay Perini, the stanza lecturer for 2009, and we're in the middle of the Bar Theatre, sort of concourse area. So, Jay, what's it like being back in St Andrews?
Do you know, I was living in St Andrews between 1968 and 75. And during that time, we had several poetry festivals. I was the organizer of one or two of them. And they were much more ramshackle, unorganized affairs. What impresses me about Stanza is how incredibly efficient it all is, how much is going on, how organized it is. And the level of enthusiasm is, to me, staggering. I mean, we had to go around giving out leaflets, begging people to turn up to readings by Stephen Spender and Norman McCaig and people like that back in the late 60s. And we would be lucky to get a small room for Stephen Spender. In fact, I do remember for Spender we had about 8 people. And now, the other day I went to Simon Armitage, for example, and it was standing room only.
Yeah.
I mean, all of the events are booked to the teeth. So I'm stunned by the level of interest in poetry. I'm stunned by the incredible organizational powers of the people putting this festival together. And it's always a thrill to be back in St. Andrews. St. Andrews is a much more bustling, attractive place now than it was 40 years ago when I was here. It seemed like a very remote outpost then. English was almost not taught. Certainly there was no such thing as creative writing. Poets had to hide out here and never show their face. Now the place is extremely welcoming to writers of all kinds, and it's become a hub for creative writing, which is a startling thing to observe, and a very good one.
Now, 2 years ago when Alistair Reid was here, he was saying how much he hated the Scotland of the 60s and 70s, and that's one of the reasons why he decided not to live there at that time. Now, there's been a huge change in Scottish culture. Have you noticed something like that coming back?
Yeah, well, there's been a revival of some kind in Scotland. I don't know how to explain it. Certainly in the 60s and 70s, Scotland was a rather dour place, dour, and there was a little bit of a pale over it. Not now. It's the sky is bright and crisp, and everybody's cheerful, and there's a lot of writing. I think it might have something to do with just how things shift over the years. I don't know what it is. The organic development of literature in St. Andrews. I mean, this was an obvious sort of place for literature to take root and grow. And I think there have always been poets skulking about the streets, but now they're much more out in the open, and it's a much more cheerful sort of attitude.
And is that a good thing?
Well, you know, I have to say there's something to be said for the old ramshackle St. Andrews, the more informal sense that if you wanted to be a writer, you had to figure it out and you had to go find older writers who would help you informally. In some ways, I prefer that to the formalization and the careerization of poetry. That's always been rather off-putting to me. In America, of course, creative writing has taken root. The universities teach it like crazy. It's a little overmuch now.
And now we've got the opportunity to hear a little bit from today's Poetry Breakfast, which was on the topic of whether actors or poets are better readers of poetry. Susan Roberts, the head of radio drama for BBC North and a former director and producer of BBC's Poetry Please, started the ball rolling.
You know, of course it is always incredibly valuable to hear a poet reading their own work, and I think that goes without saying, that there always is a direct contact between the mind of the writer and what's kind of coming out of the mouth. But yes, I mean, in terms of radio, you don't have any body language at all. You've only got the voice, and that is a particular skill. And I would still say it's always valuable to hear a poet reading their own work. But, you know, you do need space for the skill of lifting particularly a longer piece of work off the page and delivering it to an audience who's not just going to switch the radio off.
We then heard from actor Kristen Bonham Carter.
When you read a poem to yourself, and most poetry now, I presume, is read, isn't it, rather than being listened to, that you're able to read a poem with no distractions, and that's one of the joy of reading. And I think possibly what I would say is that when if someone's delivering a poem to be listened to, if the audience are having to listen hard because it's been mumbled or something, you know, then that is a distraction. And if it doesn't matter who's reading it, you know, and it's about delivering something with no distraction.
Radio is, I see that, you know, theatre is a really good medium for poetry. I think radio is a perfect medium for poetry as well, because there are no distractions again. Yeah. It's just the voice and the words.
Crispin then entertained us all with a tale.
Two old Russian actors were discussing what it is that actors get paid for. And this younger actor was there, and he was saying, well, surely it's something to do with the creating excitement on stage. And they're saying, well, no, not really, because, you know, you only need to go to a football match to see people being exciting. And, you know, they were saying, well, surely it's something to do with the words. And they're saying, well, no, you get words from a poet, or you get words from a book or something. They found that almost everything that actors get paid for, you can go and see somewhere else, either at a concert or at a dance or something like that. And it came down to the one final thing that they identified as being the actual essence of what actors get paid for, and it was the pause.
We then decided to try an experiment and get an actor and a poet to read the poet's work. In this case, it was The Times We Live In by Ros Brackenbury. And we start with Crispin Bonham Carter reading Ros's poem, followed by Ros reading it herself.
The Times We Live In. Watch me, I'll watch you watching. I'll invite you in, I'll be under the bed. Taking notes, the eye behind the one-way mirror, your numbers are all known. Security has you down, your credit rating. Age, abode, sexual proclivities, occupation, your PIN number, license, ID. Poet, where will you go? Illusion has the world by the coattails. Your only move can be further into the real. Find it, shout its immediate name to tell what has no double. Speak and I can record you. Appear, I will copy you. You are on all our lists now, our files. Your fingerprints, DNA, we can strip you at airports, X-ray your metaphors. Go down to the bare bone, measure its density, test for treason. Examine your footwear, find the cell that will undo you, freeze you, store your sperm and eggs, unravel you. What will you hide like a blade in a home-baked loaf to cut your way out from the places we have made to fit you? What is your password? Will you eat it, swallow it, refuse to give it up? Will you make us beg for it? Will you be the last person on earth to disagree?
Roz was then invited to read the poem herself.
Okay. Well, I think it made me feel a sort of, that it's a scary poem. When I, you know, when I read it, I don't get to feel that as much as
that's interesting.
The times we live in. Watch me. I'll watch you watching. I'll invite you in, out the under the bed, taking notes, the eye behind the one-way mirror. Your numbers are all known. Security has you down. Your credit rating, age, abode, sexual proclivities, occupation, your PIN number, license, ID. Poet, where will you go? Illusion has the world by the coattails. Your only move can be further into the real. Find it. Shout its immediate name to tell what has no double. Speak, and I can record you. Appear, I will copy you. You are on all our lists now, our files. Your fingerprints, DNA. We can strip you at airports, X-ray your metaphors, go down to the bare bone, measure its density, test for treason, examine your footwear, find the cell that will undo you, freeze you, store your sperm and eggs, unravel you. What will you hide like a blade in a home-baked loaf to cut your way out from the places we have made to fit you? What is your password? Will you eat it, swallow it, refuse to give it up? Will you make us beg for it? Will you be the last person on earth to disagree?
Michael Barclay, the composer, says that he actually almost prefers other people to conduct his work rather than him to conduct it himself, because they find something in his work that he didn't know was there. I wonder if we found the same there with you, Ross.
Well, as I said, I found it more frightening to listen to than to read, because I think he brought out the menace.
I basically interpreted it, didn't I?
Yes.
I only read it once, and it seemed to me to be quite scary.
Yeah.
I probably went for that in a way that maybe is a misinterpretation.
Well, you did, but no, it wasn't. It was just it showed me something about what it's like listening to it. And I think probably I picked up something from your reading, which I did too. You know, I can't tell.
Yeah.
Just having heard it.
But that is the skill of a great actor.
But he's a great actor. Yeah, there you go. You see, I learned something from it. Yeah.
That's the beats again of that we find in many plays.
Yes. Yeah.
And the man you heard asking the questions was the chair, Neil Anderson. And we'll end this podcast with some poetry cabaret from the entertaining Elvis McGonagall.
Let's deal with global warming. Let's get that out of the way. This next poem covers the whole thing. It's all you ever need to know. The A to Z of global warming. This is called Global Warming. Spent a lot of time on the title. Global warming. Recycle! Go green! Save the planet! Don't burn holes in the sky! Stop the ice caps melting! Or those wee Arctic monkeys will die. That's it, that's covered that. Excellent. That, in fact, saves you seeing Al Gore's film. It's a funny thing that global warming, I think they've got the branding wrong there. Global warming sounds too nice, doesn't it? Global warming, ooh, that's nice. Global warming, how about that? It should be global freezing or global drowning or something. Then we get a finger out of it. And what it boils down to essentially is the planet will be fine. The planet will lie fallow for a few million years. Let's be honest, it's us we're worried about. It's not save the planet, save us! They're all going to die! Save us! And you look around, you look at people, you look around, and you think, save the human race. Is it worth it? And then, for instance, I'll give you an example. The people of Hartlepool. Not the people of Hartlepool generally, that's a bit unkind, no. A specific incident. In 2002, the people of Hartlepool elected, exercising their hard-won right to a democratic vote, they elected as their mayor, Hangus Stonkey, a football mascot. I would just like to congratulate the people of London for going one step further. This poem is entitled, Have I Got an Inverted Pyramid of Piffle for You? It was like this. Cry hip hooray for the Henrys! It's jolly libertine weather. Squash the newt, send in the clown. What ho chat all together. Straight out of Henley, MC Bojo, London's Mr. Big, a 6 foot furry mascot in an Andy Warhol wig. What a tip top hat toptastic time, we've got the top chop keys, respect the curly whirlies, bro, ooh ah, Cantonese. Get down with the ethnics, yo, word up, Hippocrates. Umbongo, umbongo, they juiced up the Congo. What a character, what a wheeze. Tally ho man, the Bentley bus, bad Bentley bus, good golly. Choo train lager, oit, verboten. Nunc est bibendum, pass the volley. Floppy hair, wobbly bike, trendy bendy buses gay. Patronise a Piccadilly in Papua New Guinea, just jesting, yeah, okay. Bendy hair, floppy bike, wibbly wobbly bus, rumpy pumpy in flagranti, mayday, mayday, what a fuss. Wobbly hair, bendy bike, floppy bus, crikey, what a bore. Can I stop being mayor now, matron? This joke isn't funny anymore, thank you. Thank you very much. One of the good things, hopefully, about whatever this is, I don't know, credit crunch, the past credit crunch, haven't we? We're now in recession, next week will be depression, probably the end of Western civilization in by in a couple of weeks' time. One of the good things will be, possibly, fingers crossed, I don't know if you have them around here, I haven't seen them in St. Andrews, the ghastly drinking emporia, you know, the binge drinking palaces. Pubs the size of football pitches, with scummy TV everywhere, and hideous music, you can't hear yourself, and you have to talk in semaphore, and people are just necking it down there. Ghastly places. This is a wee poem dedicated to those kind of places. It's written as a sonnet. Posh poem. This is called Ode to the Shuttlecock and Tunnet. Shall I compare thee to the dog and duck? You are less shabby, much more shabby chic. Watering hole of the braying young buck. Your DJ is chilled, your vibe so boutique. You scorn pickled eggs and pork scratching scrunch. Have a sea salt and balsamic cashew. Passes, passe, pinstripe ploughman do brunch. Braised rump of gnu in a raspberry jus. But cloth cap ghosts drink at your zinc top bar. Their spit and sawdust memories no more. The snug was once their smoke stained Shangri-La. Hound sleeping on its fireside flagstone floor. Time, gentlemen, please, to turn back the years. Let pubs be pubs again. Mine's a pint. Cheers. Thank you. Moving swiftly on from tea to the Taliban to, let's move on to coffee. War on coffee. This is a piece written for Saturday Live and Radio 4 occasionally, and you have to write something about something who's in the show. And there's this wonderful piece where one of the listeners, they do these little things called Guerrilla Report, and they go out and do a wee report or something. And this fella, bless him, it's fantastic. He doesn't like high street coffee stores. I noticed there's lots of nice looking independent wee shops around St. Andrews, coffee shops. And this fella didn't like the high street stuff. And he didn't like the way they were all run. So what he does, he goes with his son into them, and he takes a mug with him, and they order a big one, and then they split it between the two of them. And he's beating the system. I just think that's beautiful. That's sort of poetry in itself. Anyway, this was written for him. This is called Frothing Mad. Wake up and smell the prophet. It's a roasted bean bonanza. They've struck it rich with hot black gold. It's a Costa Packet coffee shop extravaganza. It's flat pack counterculture in high street Wi-Fi boho beige. But I'm the Don Quixote of the daily grind on the boil with Java rage. No! I don't want a blueberry muffin with that. Or a funky blend from Guadalajara. Hey, Mr. Barista, I'm no mug, I'm caffeine Shea Guevara. Fighting the blight of the tall skinny latte, caramel decaf cappuccino, double chocolate macchiato, wet whip plus triple frappuccino, shot in the dark with a hazelnut, long black flat white with wings, and those polythene cheesy panini bum your mouth off toasty things. Why don't they charge for small, medium, large? Why is it primo, vente, grande, mucho, macho, ridiculoso, massivo, pavarotti, elefante? Yes, I stand alone like King Canute against the relentless corporate tide of the Have a Nice Day Mega Bucks Cafe, the bland leading the bland worldwide. It's all that Jennifer Aniston's fault, her and her friends at Central Puck, sipping no fun drip with soya, driving me berserk. So head held high, I head back home, past the old greasy spoon, R.I.P., to lead the revolution from my armchair. Feet up with a nice cup of tea. Thank you.
Well, I think all of us at Stanza will take Elvis's advice and go and have a long lie in an easy chair with a cup of tea. After an extremely successful festival, tonight's our last night. We have a couple of events that are actually happening as I'm recording this podcast, so we'll continue to have podcasts with material that we weren't able to include in the daily episodes, and also with other material from tonight. Hope you've enjoyed listening to these podcasts as much as it's been enjoyable to attend the events and figure out what to include in them. My name's Colin Fraser and I've produced these podcasts, with thanks again to all those people who've contributed over the past 5 days, and to Ewan McLean and Jill Bowman for providing music for these podcasts. From our makeshift studio in the dressing rooms, backstage in the Barra Theatre, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.